Julian Barrett continues reading our Book of the Week, A Broken Hallelujah by Leel Leibowitz. Today, struggling with drugs and depression, Leonard Cohen tries to make sense of his inner life. Extracts from his personal papers are read by Colin Stinton.
The woman in blue, she's asking for revenge. The man in white, that's you, says he has no friends.
It was May the 4th, 1970, and Leonard Cohen and his newly formed band of musicians, under the influence of a copious amount of drugs, were playing the second night of their first ever tour together in Musikhalle, Hamburg. As they were about to begin, news came of the shootings at Kent State University, which left 4 dead and 9 wounded. Stage fright, mandrax, and political violence proved a heady cocktail. Cohen took the stage, played a few songs, then goose-stepped and Zeke Heiled. His outstretched arm drove the crowd mad. They were shouting. Some stormed the stage, which Cohen seemed to encourage. Someone thought someone had a gun. The police grew jittery. Peace was barely restored. Members of the band threatened to quit. None did. And Cohen's entourage, feeling more like a military unit than a band of touring musicians, became known as the Army. Cohen, its commander, was on the attack. Everywhere he went, he challenged the local police. At the Olympia, Paris's celebrated concert hall, he urged the thousands in attendance to defy security and join him on stage. In Copenhagen, he had them follow him to his hotel. But if the local security guards were easy to overcome, the critics were less so. In London, Cohen sold out the Royal Albert Hall but failed to win over the press. His concerts, went the consensus, left deep impressions of a sad and tortured wasteland. The politics, the police, and the frenzy exhausted Cohen. When the whole world was going mad, where did you go for shelter?
I want to play mental asylums,
Cohen told his producer Bob Johnston.
In a sense, when someone consents to go into a mental hospital or is committed, he has already acknowledged a tremendous defeat, or, to put it another way, he has already made a choice, and it was my feeling that the elements to this choice corresponded with certain elements that produced my songs, and that there'd be an empathy between the people who had this experience and the experience as documented in my songs.
On August the 28th, the Army set up a makeshift stage in Henderson Hospital, an institution that focused on talking therapies and did not believe in heavy sedation. Most of those in attendance were young, and underneath one of the tall, narrow windows that gave the room the feel of a chapel, Leonard looked at the audience.
There was a fellow I spoke to last night, a doctor. I told him I was coming out here. He said, "They are a tough bunch of young nuts."
There was some applause, and Cohen started playing Bird on the Wire. But then he stopped.
"I feel like talking. Someone warned me downstairs that all you do here is talk. That's psychotic. It's contagious."
During 80 minutes, he played only 11 songs. The rest of the time, he told the audience about how a song called You Know Who I Am was written after taking 300 acid trips. He talked about the Chelsea Hotel and life in New York and making love and sharing lovers and feeling inconsolably sad. Each time he finished a song or a speech, the audience applauded rapturously. Later, when they were packing up, he said to the Army,
"I've never felt so good playing before people. This is the audience we've been looking for."
A few weeks after returning to the United States, Cohen and the Army stepped into a Nashville studio to record his third album, Songs of Love and Hate, which was dark and austere. Most of its songs had been written while on tour, and they captured their author's mood perfectly. The opening track, Avalanche, begins,
"I stepped into an avalanche. It covered up my soul."
Having lived for the first time the life of an entertainer obliged to meet his fans and their demands, Cohen contemplated the undertaking and found it a catastrophe. Songs of Love and Hate was a dismal failure in the United States, but was ecstatically received in Europe. In England, critics were now calling Cohen Laughing Len, and jokes abounded about his music being a soundtrack to suicide. He nonetheless appealed to large audiences, and Columbia pressured him into another promotional tour through Europe in March 1972. It wasn't any easier the second time around. The crowds, which 2 years earlier were still gripped by the radical politics of the 60s, were now expecting nothing more than easy listening. Cohen was flummoxed. By the time the tour ended, with a special concert in Jerusalem, he was so emotionally exhausted he broke down in tears and had to stop the concert for a long stretch and recover in his dressing room. Then, on October the 6th, 1973, the war in Israel broke out. Cohen flew to Tel Aviv as soon as he heard the news. He left behind his lover, Suzanne, a young woman he had met a few years earlier in a hotel elevator and with whom, despite never bothering to make it official, he had lived as husband and wife ever since. But he couldn't stay away from Tel Aviv. He had no idea why, or what he would do once he arrived. Meanwhile, in cafes all over Tel Aviv, singers, actors and musicians gathered in haste to plan impromptu tours of the front lines, eager to provide a few hours of entertainment for the men fighting and dying there. In one such cafe, a handsome pop star called Oshik Levy recognized Cohen and asked him if he'd like to join him. Cohen, intrigued, agreed, and they left Tel Aviv that same night, their first stop being the Southern Air Force Base in Hatzor. When Levy took the small makeshift stage and said that he was happy to announce a very special guest performer, Leonard Cohen, at first no one clapped. No one believed him. The silence persisted when Cohen stepped out, blinking at the bright spotlights in his eyes. Then, rapture. A throng of exhausted soldiers howling and clapping wildly. After years of growing anxiety and creeping despair, something in Cohen was transformed. As soon as he stepped off the stage, he took his guitar and wrote a new song, Lover, Lover, Lover.
Yes, and lover, 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 come back to me. And may the spirit of this song, may it rise up pure and free. May it be a shield for you, a shield against the enemy.
The same spirit guided Cohen in the days and weeks that followed, removed from fame and its expectations. A light-heartedness guided Cohen's next two albums, one of which he recorded with the mad and armed Phil Spector. By the early 1980s, Cohen was in his mid-40s, with a string of tepidly received albums to his name, but, he confessed,
almost no personal life.
He had separated from Suzanne, and she took both their children. A daughter, Lorca, named after his beloved poet, was born in 1974, and moved to Europe, leaving Cohen lonely and confused. To cope, Cohen turned to Rinzai Buddhism. His involvement with the Japanese sect began in the late 1960s, when a mutual friend introduced him to Kaizen Joshu Sasaki, known as Roshi, or Venerable Teacher. Far from being incompatible with Judaism, the old master's views underscored many of the central mysteries with which Cohen had struggled since being steeped in the old religion as a child, including the question concerning the nature of God. As long as we see things dualistically, read a line in the official journal of Roshi's monastery on Mount Baldy, we shall never see the truth. In the state of zero, there are no questions. But how to get to a state of zero? For Leonard Cohen, that was what life was increasingly about. John Lissauer, a talented young producer who had worked with Cohen on a previous album, was intrigued to hear from the singer after almost a decade. Lissauer knew about Cohen's turbulent personal life and expected to meet a more weathered man. But nothing prepared him for the sight of the troubadour exchanging his guitar for one of those toy gizmos hawked in tourist trap shops all along Broadway, making a sound that was tinny and flat. Cohen pressed a button, and the machine spat out a tacky rhythm. Then Cohen played a new song. It was called Dance Me to the End of Love, and it sounded very different from Cohen's earlier work. It wasn't only the change of instrument. There was something more mature about the song. It was a different Leonard doing the singing, one who seemed at once more present and almost entirely abstract. Cohen's new songs sounded like prayers.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you?
One of the new songs Cohen played for Lissauer was Hallelujah.
The minor fall, the major lift.
The transcendent and earthly intermingling was Cohen's oldest trick. But here he cuts it short. The very next verse does something strange.
Your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you.
From merely singing about the biblical king, Cohen continues by addressing him directly. The bather on the roof, we assume, is Bathsheba, condemning us to spend the rest of the song steeped in confusion. Who is he talking to or about? Himself? Some unnamed lover? King David? Another biblical figure? He could be talking to anyone. And the song could be taking place any time and anywhere. Judging by the number of cover versions, the song is, indeed, everyone's. But it only takes a passing acquaintance with the other Hallelujahs to realize just how towering Cohen's achievement truly was. Overcome with emotion, they take the song, as had its best-known interpreter, Jeff Buckley, to be about the Hallelujah of the orgasm, the turning loose of emotion.
But remember when I moved in you and the holy dove was moving too and every breath we drew is how.
Cohen himself has none of that. He sings it simply and straightforwardly, so that the last verse is strongest.
And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of Song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah.
It's a startling end to the song. We expect a measure of resolution or at least a concluding statement about love. Instead, Cohen ends up all by himself, talking to God, admitting defeat.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
By 1990, Cohen had become a slim, aging guru to a generation of artists. His career was met first by befuddlement and scorn, and only later by universal admiration. But the strangest chapter of his career was yet to come.
Julian Barrett was reading A Broken Hallelujah by Leel Riebewitz, with Colin Stinton as the voice of Leonard Cohen. The producer was Pippa Vaughan, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4.